Welcome to Brad Kyle's Brad's Motorworks podcast. We'll be talking about some things about BMW, some things of cars in general, and some things about car repair. I hope you find it educational, enlightening, and I hope it increases your understanding of your car. And maybe along the way we'll have some fun too. Thank you for listening, and here we go. Episode number 35, BMW Vanos, Valvetronic, and DI. What are they? I'm going to try not to get too technical on this one, but I am going to give some background information before I get started on the Vanos. Just real quick, Vanos is what's called variable camshaft timing. But prior to that, I realized that prior to Vanos, basically the engineers and mechanical engineers, the camshaft is what controls the opening time and rate of the intake and exhaust valves. Okay, this is what allows air to go into the engine, and then on the exhaust side, the burn gases from the combustion process go out through the exhaust valves. Okay, so previously to Vanos, that had to be all designed into the when they ground the camshaft, which is rotating, and it's timed to the crankshaft, which is connected to the connecting rods, which is connected to the pistons, which are going up and down. So they had to kind of make decisions ahead of time and make compromises of if this was going to be a, let's say, a performance-oriented engine, then the camshaft would be ground a certain way and it would be timed a certain way. And there was no, once that was set up, you know, in design and then, of course, in assembly, there was no variance there. It was all, there was nothing they could work with, okay? Whereas if it was going to be, let's say, a mileage-type motor where power was not the main criteria, it was fuel mileage and lower emissions, then the cam would be ground a different way, and it would be timed a different way, okay? With the advent of Vanos, which came in, for BMW, it came in around about the 93 or 94 model year, approximately. It depends on the engine we're talking about. But basically, Vanos is what's called variable camshaft timing. So what they did by using sensors and as part of the engine management system, there was a electrically controlled solenoid that controlled oil flow to this mechanical device that would allow the intake camshaft only to be advanced or retarded based on what the engine management system was telling it to do. So it allowed them to advance or retard the camshaft timing. So now all of a sudden it opened up the world where the torque range of the engine became more, let's say, variable. It became where they could play around with it. So if someone was accelerating really hard, it would advance the cam timing and give more power, and they weren't concerned about emissions at that point. Whereas if somebody was driving the car easier, it would retard the cam timing. Okay. Now, in the original, what's called single Vanos, it would only work on the intake cam. And when I say variable, it was either one or the other. So in other words, it was either retarded or advanced. There was no, it was almost like a snap kind of a thing. It either it went one way or the other. Around about 98, 99 model year, right in that area, they went to what's called dual Vanos, which means it's adjusting both the intake and the exhaust camshafts, and more importantly, it is variable. So it's the actual cam positions that the engine management system could call for were infinitely variable within the adjustment range. But now we were talking about both intake and exhaust. So that gives the engine designers way more leeway. And so what happens, you know, to the driver, to the seat of the pants? You can have maximum torque available at a much lower RPM. Okay, I know I've talked about this before in other podcasts, but you know, in the old days, with fixed cam timing and so on and so forth, even a high performance engine, you know, you might get at maximum horsepower around maybe 3,800 to 4,500 RPM, and maximum torque was right about in that same area. Okay, in today's world, with all these other different engine management functions and systems that are available, you could have maximum torque down as low as 1500 or 1600 RPM. I mean, it's really kind of amazing in that regard. And again, torque is a measurement of a twisting action. What that comes down to, bottom line, is that that's the feeling of the seat of the pants of acceleration when you punch it. Okay, when you apply the throttle and you feel that pull on your body, you are feeling the effect of torque. Okay, so to have maximum torque on an engine at 1,300, 1,500 RPM is really quite amazing, really. So Vanos really was part of that. You know, that's what helps in that scenario, to be able to have that kind of torque available at such a lower range. It also, again, because of this adjustability of the cam timing, it does give you more power and lower emissions at any given engine load. Okay, so that's basically Vanos, is variable camshaft timing with BMW. That was either single or dual Vanos, and the dual Vanos is infinitely adjustable within its adjustment window. Okay, I mean, you can go too far, which it's not, you know, it's not possible, because it's mechanically in a BMW Vanos system, it's mechanically limited. Okay, but it's not like you can just do whatever you want, because at some point you're going to have pistons hitting valves, which is, that's not good. That damages the valves and your engine quits. It's the end of it. So that's Vanos. Valvetronic, it's also called VVO, but BMW calls it Valvetronic. This is a system that is, there is actually no throttle plate in the intake system. I say that there is actually a small there is actually a throttle plate, but it's used strictly for control of flow of crankcase vapors, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But essentially, there is no longer a mechanical connection, and there is no throttle plate, which is normally used to control the airflow into the engine. So when you normally, in the past, when you operated the throttle pedal, you were either mechanically or electronically operating what's called a throttle butterfly plate, and that's controlling how much air is fed into the engine. Of course, more air, and the system adds more fuel, more fire, so to speak. In other words, more combustion going on in the combustion chamber, and you go faster. The engine speeds up, you go faster. Okay, well, with a throttle plate, you know, you've got atmospheric pressure on one side, on the outside of the engine, so to speak, and because these pistons are going down and the intake valves are opening, it recreates a negative pressure, or what's called a vacuum, within the intake manifold. And of course, that travels also, that's also comes from the combustion chamber at that point, because this piston is traveling down, so it creates a negative pressure. Well, for the engine to do that, to create a negative pressure, it means that it takes engine power to create that negative pressure, which ultimately equates to lower fuel mileage and higher emissions. Okay. So BMW, as well as a number of other car companies, realized, well, wait a minute, if we can control the opening, not only the time, but the amount that the intake valves open, okay, because realize, well, let me backtrack for a minute. In the engine I just described, as far as a non-Valvetronic engine that has a throttle butterfly plate, the opening, the timing and the opening amount of the intake valves are controlled by the camshaft, but the bottom line is they always open the same amount, okay, whatever that is. It's called lift, valve lift. In an older style engine, they always open the same amount, okay? So the way you control airflow into the engine is through this throttle butterfly plate. With Valvetronic, you remove the throttle butterfly plate. It's no longer needed, because now what you're doing is you're controlling the amount, not only the timing, which is still by the camshaft, but you're controlling the amount or the height that the intake valve opens. So at idle, you open it a little small amount, very little air goes in, and of course the engine management system matches the fuel to the amount of air and the other, you know, considerations that it looks at. So the engine idles. As you press on the accelerator, The system realizes you're asking for more power. So based on other parameters that it's looking at, it makes adjustments to where it opens up the valves a little bit more. And you apply more throttle and it opens them more, and so on and so forth. Okay. So what's happening is you're reducing or eliminating what's called suction throttling losses. That's the technical whiz-bang word for when you remove the throttle butterfly and there's no longer a vacuum created within the intake manifold. Because what happens now is that because the intake valves are varying as far as they're opening, you basically have no vacuum created within the manifold anymore, because the vacuum area is right at the intake valves. Okay. The downside to it, a small downside, which this is why it does actually have a throttle valve, is you need a certain amount, a small amount of vacuum within the intake manifold for the crankcase breather system to work, what's called PCV, and also for the fuel evaporative emission system to work, because those gases have to be drawn into the intake manifold to be burned by the engine. So there is a throttle valve within the intake manifold. The bottom line is it's basically almost open completely wide. Okay. It is also there, though, for emergency purposes. If the valvetronic system were to go bonkers and go bad, okay, and let's say somehow it got stuck wide open or partway open, okay, you would lose throttle control. In other words, the engine would be like a runaway. You wouldn't be able to control it. So the other function that this throttle valve does, besides creating a slight vacuum in the intake manifold, is it's there for emergency purposes. So if the system realizes the valvetronic has stuck open somehow, it will close or, you know, vary that throttle valve as a backup, okay? But 99.9% of the time, it is barely closed, like I say, to create this very minimum vacuum in the intake manifold. So suction throttling losses are just that. It's like I mentioned a minute or so ago, is that now the engine no longer has to spend any time or energy creating a vacuum within the intake manifold. So the idea being is that it does increase fuel mileage and lower emissions. The other thing is that theoretically, since the air is available right there at the intake manifold, you have potentially more instantaneous throttle response, okay? Because it does take time for air to move, okay? When an intake valve starts to open, there's an actual pressure wave that is created that the air has to start flowing, okay? It doesn't just, you know, snap to attention instantaneously. There is a slight delay. It takes time for air to move. So in theory, it does increase the throttle response of the engine. So there are some good things about it. The downside, it creates a valve train system that is way, way more complex. There's what's called an eccentric shaft, which essentially that's part of the valvetronic system. What it does, the way that this creates a situation where you can change the valve opening of the intake valves, is essentially what it's doing is it's changing the rocker arm ratio, okay, which in the past that was impossible to do. Again, the rocker arms were, you know, designed and made to fit a certain function, what the design goals of were the engine, and once it's machined and made, that's it. It's set. You can't change it, okay. Valvetronic with this eccentric shaft, which is driven by what's called the valvetronic motor, it rotates, and so it essentially is changing or varying the rocker arm ratio, which then ultimately changes how far the intake valves open at any given time. Okay, it does not do it individually per cylinder. It does it on all the cylinders at one time, whether it be an inline six-cylinder engine or for that matter an inline four or a V8. Now, of course, on a V8 or a V motor that has valvetronic, you're going to have this system on both banks. Either bank will have its own valvetronic motor, eccentric shaft, so on and so forth. So it's a very complex system. This is a system that when it first came out, they were having a lot of problems over time with wear because some of the different parts were not hardened really properly. They kind of had to learn as they go. I think initially, in my opinion, they kind of made some of the parts not as well as they could have. Whether that was knowingly or not, who's to say? But there was a lot of problems with wear. The hardening on some of the parts would wear through. And to me, this is also in correlation with where, with them going to higher fuel, higher mileages between oil changes. It's just not a good idea. I know I've talked about oil change and the, using the right quality of oil. I'm trying to think. That's probably in. Let's see. Well, I should have had this video. Episode number 7, I talk more about it, oil changes and quality of oil. So if you want to check into that, I would definitely encourage you to do that. But there's problems with wear. And so, getting back to oil changes, this is another reason why I recommend oil changes at like 5,000 mile intervals. When these cars that have Valtronic first came out, this is when they were going along with the 15,000 mile interval oil change. Not a good idea if you're planning on keeping the car any kind of long term amount. Unless you're going to trade it in at like 80 or 100,000 miles and get something else, if you're having any plans of keeping it over 100,000 miles, or for that matter, if you're buying a car used and you don't know the past history, there's nothing wrong with going ahead and start changing the oil at 5,000 mile intervals. The downside to it is you certainly can't reverse whatever wear has already occurred. That's just the way it is. But you can certainly, from that point on, you can certainly slow down any additional wear that might happen, and you're doing the engine a favor, all in all, by doing oil changes more often. The other issue with Valvetronic is we are definitely seeing issues with what's called the eccentric shaft sensor. Now, this is a very important sensor. It's what actually reads the rotation of the eccentric shaft, okay? It sees what its location is, so to speak, as far as its rotation. And, of course, this is after the fact. In other words, the system, at any given engine load or whatever, it knows where the eccentric shaft is. And when you apply throttle or you do something with the throttle, it knows where it needs to go to. And so the Valtronic motor turns the eccentric shaft and the sensor feeds that information back to say, okay, this is what we commanded. Yes, we've gone to that point. Okay. So it's a very, very important sensor. It's a very expensive sensor. And the downside to it is that typically, depending upon the engine design, you've got to remove the valve cover to be able to replace it. So that job in and of itself, depending upon which engine, can be easily over $1,000. Actually, wait a minute. It can be more like around $1,500 or $1,600 or more. Okay. Now, some of the newer engine designs, they have made that sensor easier to replace. They're realizing, oh, well, this sensor is not making it very far. And what happens typically is oil starts to come up through the sensor itself, okay? Because you realize part of it, half of it, so to speak, is inside the valve cover. So it's exposed to all the oil that's splashing around inside there. And it's what's, that part of it is what sees the position of the eccentric shaft. The other half of it is on the outside of the valve cover, so it's just out in open air, and that's where the electrical harness connects to it, okay? And it is a multi-pin connector. There's about 8 or 9 pins there with wiring going to it. So what happens is the oil starts to come up through that sensor and contaminate the electrical connector end of it, which there are certainly things within oil it starts to become conductive. So bottom line, what happens is that the readings that come from the eccentric shaft start to become kind of all wonky, and the system realizes, wait a minute, that's, something's wrong here. And it can either Depending upon the situation, it can either put the Valvetronic system into a fail-safe, which means you may not get any more than about 20 or 30 miles an hour out of it. So the car is sort of drivable, kind of. It gets you off the road. That would be like worst-case scenario. What typically happens is where intermittently things will happen. You'll get to where it won't give maximum power for a while, and then the next drive cycle it'll work okay. During that whole time, though, you're going to have a service engine soon light on, which, you know, person goes, well, something's not right. And of course, it does affect emissions and so on and so forth. So that sensor is, you know, it's very important. And again, my feeling as far as Valvetronic is concerned, you know, the biggest thing you could do as the owner of the car that you certainly have a choice about is oil and filter changes. I tell people 5,000 miles, you know. One of the reasons I use that particular number is that, again, when these engines came out, it was 15,000 miles that BMW recommended oil changes. They have since dropped down, especially with the turbocharger engines, they have dropped down to 10,000 miles. So what I'm trying to accomplish by using 5,000 is, you know, something that's divisible of either 10,000 or 15,000. So that way we're not using, like, you know, do it every 6,300 miles, because obviously the math doesn't add up properly. So what I'm trying to accomplish is to recommend to you to do more oil and filter changes, you know, more often, but it's still, you know, mathematically, it still goes in with what BMW recommends. So you're basically just getting either one or two extra oil changes between what BMW recommends. Okay. DI, what is it? That's direct fuel injection. Just a quick background. Prior to direct injection, at least certainly with BMW, and I'm sure most of the manufacturers that have gone to DI, we had what was called MPI, manifold port injection. And that's where the fuel injector was basically mounted to where it was spraying fuel on the back of the intake valve. Okay, now remember I just finished talking about you've got an intake manifold where the air is coming in. It flows, when the intake valve is open, it flows through the intake valve into the combustion chamber area. Okay. So with MPI, you were spraying fuel directly on the back of the intake valve. And as the air, on some engines, on old technology, it was sprayed all the time. Sequential or semi-sequential fuel injection, it was sprayed twice for every cylinder operation. In other words, as the intake valve was getting ready to open, it would spray half the fuel, and then while the valve was open, it would spray the other half. Full sequential injection on MPI is just that. It's timed to when the intake valve is going to open, and as it opens, it sprays all of the fuel that the engine management system has figured out that that's what the engine needs for that given load and temperature and so on and so forth. Okay, so there are advantages with MPI, and I'll talk about those in a moment as compared to DI. Direct injection is where the fuel is sprayed directly into the combustion chamber. Okay, it's a goal they've had for many, many years because there are some definite advantages about it. Okay, but prior to, you know, relatively recently, when they were able to come up with the proper components and parts and figure this thing out, it requires, you know, very high-speed computer management systems. There's a lot going on when you start talking about direct injection. But essentially, it's spraying the fuel directly into the combustion chamber, basically on top of the piston. The advantages of it are that you get what's called better atomization of the fuel. The fuel is under much, much higher pressure. It can be upwards of 5,000 PSI, depending upon the system, okay? Whereas normal fuel pressure for like an MPI system might be anywhere from about 35 to 55 PSI, meaning pounds per square inch. Direct injection, obviously because of the pressures that were involved in a combustion chamber, this is one reason why it took so long to make it happen, is that the pressures that are already there that are being produced because of the piston coming up and it's under on the compression stroke, you've got to have a system that has creates more fuel pressure than what that pressure is that's being created with inside the combustion chamber. Otherwise, the fuel is not going to come out. It's going to be forced backwards, so to speak. So a direct injection system literally can be upwards of anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 PSI. Okay, well, that will definitely overcome the pressures that's created within the combustion chamber on the compression stroke. Okay. So with DI, you get better fuel atomization. Okay. You end up with more power, lower emissions. The engine can potentially run leaner. Okay, with still the same amount of power. So in other words, again, it goes back to better fuel mileage. You can more control the fuel flow into the engine. You can multiple spray it, which is a new thing that's coming out or has been out for a while. It's not just one shot of fuel. They will literally can inject it numerous times during any one combustion process. It kind of depends on what their goals are, but I mean, engines in general and manufacturers in general are certainly looking for more power, better fuel mileage, lower emissions. Those are their primary goals, and if they can accomplish all of that, they feel they've done a pretty good job. And certainly with this newer technology, it is, again, it's amazing the amount of power that they're getting out of the engines with less fuel and still being able to create lower emissions as well. It really is amazing type stuff. The downsides to it is there's a lot more to go wrong potentially. It is obviously a lot more complicated, not only from a design and manufacturing standpoint, but there's a lot more parts involved. And of course, from a testing and diagnostic standpoint, it is potentially, you know, it is harder. There's a lot going on. The downside to direct injection, and this is why I brought up MPI injection. The downside to it is that the crankcase breather system, which is basically collecting oil vapor that's created within the other parts of the engine, okay, and this is what's called PCV, positive crankcase ventilation, it's also the crankcase ventilation system. Those oil vapors, many, many years ago, were just dumped out into the atmosphere, okay? Nobody cared about them. We're talking about in the early days of engine design, all the way up until about 1966 or 67, when one of the very first emission system was PCV, crankcase ventilation control. They realized it's probably not a good idea we're dumping this oil vapor out into the air, into our environment, okay? Maybe we should be feeding it back into the engine under a controlled situation to allow the engine to burn it, okay? So with MPI, with any engine really, the crankcase vapors are fed into the intake manifold. Now, on our MPI system, because the fuel injector is basically aimed at the back of the intake valve, gasoline is a very good detergent. It cleans things really well. Okay, so on an MPI system, as this air and oil vapor is passing by the intake manifold, and then it's being sprayed with fuel, There's no buildup, at least not oil type vapor buildup, carbon buildup, on the back of the intake valve, because the fuel is constantly being sprayed on the valve, so it cleans it. The downside that's becoming a big problem, potentially, in some engines, when I say engines, I'm talking about all car manufacturers, some are horrible about this, is because with direct injection that the fuel is being fed or injected directly into the combustion chamber, the only thing that's going past that intake valve is air and oil vapor from the crankcase ventilation system. So because the intake valve, of course, is nice and hot, because it's right there close to the combustion chamber, this oil vapor, some of it over time, as it's passing by the intake valve, it sticks to it and it starts to burn. Okay, when I say burn, I mean not cleanly. Okay, it's not the same as burning it actually inside the engine in the combustion chamber, because there's just enough heat there to, it doesn't really burn it per se. It basically, it heats it up enough to where it starts to stick to the intake manifold, and then over time it starts making these deposits. And they're carbon, but it's an oil-based carbon deposit. It's very sticky. It starts to build up. It starts to reduce airflow going into the engine through the intake valve, and it also starts to create turbulence in the airflow as it's going past the intake valve, as it's going into the engine. So the problem here is over time it starts to reduce power that's available from the engine. It starts to potentially create drivability issues, okay? And depending upon, this has become a lot more prevalent, especially with BMW, certainly. When they've gone to turbocharging and direct injection, some of those engines have Valvetronic, some of them don't. Doesn't really matter in a way as far as that part of it. But the downside with direct injection is this carbon buildup issue on the back of the intake valves. There's a number of ways of removing it. The chemical industry, as far as companies that make automotive chemicals, they are trying to come up with ways of doing this to where you can remove it chemically, where you don't have to do any engine disassembly or very minimal. That is one way. They right now at this date, which this is, it's almost July of 2019, there are certainly some chemical companies that claim, oh yeah, we have this process, it'll take care of it, it'll remove it. That's not necessarily the case all the time. Okay, part of it is just how long this stuff's been building up and how bad it is. The technology is always changing on that. But essentially, the various ways to remove the carbon is either remove the intake manifold and physically scrape it off, okay? And we're talking about a very tedious, time-consuming, mind-numbing affair, okay? That's one way. Another way is to use walnut shells and blast it off. This is something that we actually had to do when I was at the dealership. That was what's called the 1986 engine campaign. And there was carbon on the backs of the intake valves, but at that time, the carbon was coming from the fuel, okay? And this is why Chevron came out with Tecron, and this is how at that time, where fuels were what became what was called top tier or tier one, okay? If you're using, you want to be using a tier one fuel, not to get off subject here, but there are different types of carbon that can form on the backs of the intake valves. And way back when, it was from the fuel, okay? Well, that's long since been taken care of, okay? That situation has been resolved. And what's happening now with DI and these crankcase vapors is now the carbon is oil-based, okay? So it's causing the same kinds of problems, sort of, okay? But frankly, this oil-based carbon is actually causing really more problems, drivability issues, than the carbon-based, the fuel-based carbon caused in the 80s. The fuel-based carbon, when it was forming in the 1980s with BMW, the symptom typically was the car would start and die, start and die, start, run rough, and if you could kind of keep it running and blip through the throttle for maybe a minute, the car ran perfectly fine after that. You couldn't tell any difference. The reason being is that fuel-based carbon kind of acts like a sponge when it's cold. And so the fuel that was being injected on the back of the intake valve, because that was MPI at the time, it would get soaked up, so to speak, or sucked up by this fuel-based carbon. And once the engine ran for 15, 20 seconds, a minute or whatever, and this carbon was now soaked, okay, then the rest of the fuel that was being injected in would actually go into the engine and the engine will run fine and you wouldn't know the difference. Oil-based carbon isn't that way. And plus the fact, like I mentioned with DI, the fuel is being fed directly into the combustion chamber. So there's nothing there to wash off this carbon, and it starts to affect the airflow into the engine. And in today's world of engine design, I mean, all of this stuff, airflow, and there's times where they want turbulence in some parts of the combustion chamber. There's other times they don't. There's a lot going on in engine design these days. I mean, we're talking about computer-aided design. We're talking about just there's a lot going on. So it means that because there's so much going on and there's potentially so many more variables, if any one of those variables get out of whack, whether it be, you know, electronically or mechanically or because of carbon buildup or whatever, and it goes beyond what the engine was originally designed to do, it's going to start affect the drivability of the car because the engine's not going to run right, whether that means a rough idle or transition from idle to acceleration or top speed or power that's available, whatever, it's going to affect it, okay? So the ways of removing that carbon, oil-based carbon, is either physically scraping it, which requires removal of the intake manifold, using walnut shells to blast it off, which requires removal of the intake manifold, or using chemicals. And like I say, right now I can't sit here and say the chemical process is going to take care of every single car. There's new processes and new chemicals coming out all the time. So as time goes by, this issue that I'm describing may become less of a problem as far as, owners actually having to deal with it on their specific car. The other side of it, people are going, well, why is this forming? I mean, there's no way of not having the crankcase vapors being fed into the intake manifold. I have read some studies, and my own personal opinion is I think you can help the situation by going back to doing oil changes more often, okay? Part of the issue by extending oil changes to what BMW says to is that even though the oil may chemically last that long, there's going to be different components, byproducts of combustion, and so on and so forth that are going to build up in that oil. And some of it's going to be vaporized. So it's now traveling through the intake manifold and it's hitting the back of that intake valve. Okay. I believe, based on studies and what I've seen, that the longer you let that oil be in there, in other words, if you extend the oil change out, you are increasing the likelihood of these different carbon particles forming on the back of the intake manifold. That's partly my own feeling, something I've observed, because frankly, I'm a very big, advocate of changing oil and filter at 5,000 mile intervals. I'm not going to sit there and say I hammer people, my customers, about it, but I certainly talk to them about it. And for me personally, in my experience, and again, I'm a one-man shop, so I see a very low volume of cars on any one day, okay, compared to someone, a shop that's got multiple technicians, okay? I very rarely actually see a carbon buildup issue on direct injection engines, okay, where it's actually affecting drivability. But I firmly believe, that part of that, the reason I don't see it, is because I am such a strong advocate about changing oil more often. And like I say, it helps the engine all in all, okay? If you've got clean, relatively fresh oil that has a lower contamination of microscopic dirt, which of course is an abrasive, it's got a lower level of contamination of all the other byproducts of combustion, you're doing the engine a favor, okay? I mean, 5,000 miles, come on, dump the oil, put a new oil filter in, a quality oil filter, put in the right oil, the right amount, and, do your engine a favor, okay? And frankly, you're doing yourself a favor, okay? So that's the story on that. If you want to get more direct injection information, check out episode number 19, which is actually turbo versus non-turbo cars. But I spent a lot more time talking about direct injection in that particular podcast episode. I also talk about what's called LSPI, low speed pre-ignition, but I do that way more at length in that particular episode. That's another issue with direct injection and turbocharging, but I definitely do elaborate more on that in that episode. I hope this has been informative for you. I thought it was one. I kind of combined really three different, you know, technologies in one episode, but it seemed like it made sense to me. You know, they're all basically good systems. We are definitely going forward and advancing. There's just like anything, there's upsides and downsides. And so I've tried to, you know, elaborate on both of those. We don't really have a choice. I mean, this is where we're going. The only choice you have is whether you want to, you know, go ahead and buy a newer car, or if you don't like any of this stuff, you better buy an old car or keep what you have, okay? Which is kind of what I do. I mean, I've got a 2002 530i manual transmission car. It's got the nice M54 engine in it, very reliable, very stout, and I take care of it, okay? So I hope this has been informative. I hope you'd learned a couple things as you were listening to this. That's certainly always my goal with doing these podcast series. I hope you've enjoyed it. And as always, if you want to get a hold of me, you can get me at bkpodcasts5@gmail.com. I am also on LinkedIn for those people that, you know, if you want to catch me through that. Also, wherever you got this from, whether it be iTunes, Spotify, or Podbean, if you could please leave a comment or like it, that would always is always appreciated. I hope you you found out some things as you listen to this. I appreciate your listening. I hope you have a great day and a fantastic week. And thank you for listening. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to this episode. It's been an honor and a privilege to spend time with you. I hope you found this of value. Please share it with family and friends. Above all else, with all you're getting, get understanding. May God bless you and keep you, and thank you again.